news right now, taking you back inside the courtroom at the murder trial for Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, where the question's been answered. He is taking the witness stand right now. Let's listen.
Mr. Rooker.
Thank you, Judge. Tell ladies and gentlemen of the jury your name, please, and spell your last name before the court.
Jason Van Dyke, V-A-N-D-Y-K-E.
How old are you, Jason?
I'm 40 years old.
Are you married?
Yes, I'm married to my wife, and we have two children.
How old are your children?
My children are 17 and 12.
And can you tell us about your education background?
I have a bachelor's in business from St. Xavier University.
And when did you join the Chicago Police Department?
June 25th of 2001.
So how old were you when you joined the Chicago Police Department?
23.
And the first thing you did when you joined the Chicago Police Department was what?
I went to the Chicago Police Academy.
How long were you in the academy?
About 30 weeks.
Alright. And then you were assigned a job, right?
I'm sorry?
You were assigned a district to go to?
Yes, I was.
What's the first district you went to?
First district I went to was the 9th district over on 35th and Lowell.
And what was your job or your duty when you first got to the 9th district?
I was assigned as a patrol officer. Had three cycles there, and I continued working in the 9th district.
And when you say three cycles, what are you talking about?
Three training cycles with different training officers and senior officers.
So you would ride around with a training officer for three of those cycles, right?
Yes.
How long did that take?
Each cycle was roughly 1 month.
And you stayed at the 9th district for how long?
I think so. I was there for about 2 years.
Where did you go after the 9th district?
Well, I was at the 9th district as detailed out to the traffic unit and also to the Area 1 saturation team.
And where is that district located?
Traffic unit was downtown off of 18th and State. And the Area 1 saturation team was out of the first deputy chief's office at 51st and Wentworth.
All right. Did you have occasion to go to another district after that?
I did. I went to...
Excuse me. Could I have the attorneys over here, please?
That many legal minds have been asking in this trial would Jason Van Dyke testify in his own defense? Would Officer Van Dyke take the witness stand? Well, we see that decision has been made. He is going to be giving his side of what happened that fateful night, October 10th, 2014, when he fatally shot 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. A lot of officers on the scene. It was Van Dyke who shot McDonald, who'd been wielding a knife at the time, but police dash cam video indicated the teen was moving away from officers. Van Dyke's partner testified earlier in this trial that, from their perspective, the teen posed a threat, and that's why Van Dyke fired. But jurors clearly have most likely wanted to hear from Van Dyke himself. Legal experts seem to have been divided as to whether you would put the witness, the defendant, on the stand, because the law does not require you to testify. It's innocent until proven guilty. But in a case like this, so complicated, emotionally, a controversial, polarizing case for the city of Chicago, many clearly wanted to hear from Officer Van Dyke. Paul Lisnick is joining me. He's our legal expert and political consultant here at CLTV and WGN. So,
the moment everybody's been waiting for.
Absolutely. And Gal Pasetsky, who was with me this morning, we didn't get a chance to talk about it on air, but he said he needs to testify. But not everybody thinks so. And I mean, you're more of an attorney that thinks not necessarily.
Yeah, I'm one of those that say, look, the burden of proof is completely on the prosecution. So the defendant does not have to testify. The jury is told that he doesn't have to, that it means nothing if he doesn't. They should hold nothing against him if he does not. So that's kind of the rules of the game. But you're right, Gal, and I've talked about this with him. He believes that because jurors want to hear from this defendant, certainly this defendant,
it's human nature to want to, I mean, as much
but
as...
But the risk is the cross-examination, Monica. That's the risk.
Okay, but you've got a police officer on the stand who must know how to testify. Aren't they called into court to testify at various things that they have been an officer
over? Well, you know what? If he was here taking the stand about somebody else or some other case, maybe. This is his life on the line now and his freedom on the line now. So every answer is going to have its own consequences. He's far more nervous now than he would be by testifying in any other case, I have to assume. The good news is, on direct examination, he will be allowed to say what he wants to say going forward, because he was certainly been prepared by his lawyers, I can guarantee you that. But when the prosecutor gets up to say, you know, with those leading questions, to say, all right, Officer Van Dyke, what about, and isn't it true, that can be a little more tougher. And we have to see what kind of attitude he shows the prosecutor. I guarantee if he was my client, I would be advising him, do not get belligerent, do not get angry, because the question is, rationality is an issue here in this case. Did he act rationally, right? So we want to be sure that even on cross-examination, he remains calm and collected and cool.
And you could see if he feels, as a human being, falsely accused, even as a police officer falsely accused, that he would somehow then become angry. But you're right, that could paint the wrong picture for the jurors. So this is theater in some sense, court theater. I mean, you need to get
There's no question. Listen, in kind of an analytical way, we all went through the testimony of Judge Brett Kavanaugh last week, right? And one of the issues on with regard to him was, what about his demeanor? What about his temperament? So all of a sudden, it wasn't so much about the drinking and the other allegations being made or the sexual harassment. It was his temperament here in the hearing. And is that the kind of temperament we should have in the court? So what I'm saying is that how you present yourself and how you handle the questions, that's going to impact the jurors. And part of their discussion will be not just what he said, but wow, he got so angry, if that's what happens. Like I said, I'm sure he's being counseled not to react in that way.
And some jurors might then they'd have the little battle in the deliberation room between the jurors. I'm thinking maybe not a battle, but certainly different points
discussion.
Of view. Some would say then, well, did you see that? He gets very upset. That probably would happen that night, and he didn't need to pull the trigger because he can't rein himself in. Where somebody else then might say, he is on trial for his future, his life, being away from his family, and he feels falsely accused. Of course he's going to be upset. You know, so really it can go so many different ways.
And we don't know what a jury is going to do.
But a good lawyer would tell their client, if you're going to testify, you're right. They would counsel them and practice with them and just say, this is what to expect.
Absolutely. And what you said, practice them. You can be sure that Officer Van Dyke has been put through a rigorous cross-examination, maybe even tougher than anything the prosecutor will do. These lawyers know each other. So you can be sure his lawyer has been giving him very tough questions, just like he might face here. And part of that process, and I've done witness preparation, part of my work as a jury consultant, you work with these witnesses and how they're answering the questions. Always be truthful. The answer is always the truth. But in terms of, is there a better way to say that? Is that the accurate way to say that? Or you've just admitted to something. Where's that coming from? How do you know what so-and-so is doing? So, you know, again, lawyers have a different training, a special background that can really trip up non-lawyers. Now, cops are taught how to ask questions and investigate situations. So you're right when you sort of suggested Officer Van Dyke is not new to this inquisition kind of situation, being asked questions. But at the same time, it is very different now because he's the subject of that questioning.
Certainly. Well, and what's also interesting, why if I was a juror, I guess just personally, I would want to hear from him after this latest defense witness we had, the first defense witness today, the psychologist, the expert psychologist the defense brought on to talk about police psychology, which is his area, in terms of how officers react in these types of shooting situations where the trained first responders trying to go in, go towards the danger, and how oftentimes it's tunnel vision and time compression, and they go based on their training, and they sometimes don't even remember the whole thing because you're so in the moment. But then the prosecution was able to bring in there a few things like, well, this is all based on what Jason Van Dyke told you, trying to sort of say, well, you know, people do lie sometimes or try to paint themselves in a better fashion, and you don't know anything other than what he told you.
Right.
And so he had to sort of admit that and that people do lie. So given that, I guess as a juror would want to hear from Jason Van Dyke himself so people could go with their own gut. Is he being truthful about the way this happened, and was he just going by police procedure and his training, or was something else going on here?
And Monica, that's exactly the question that jurors have to ask. It's what they're going to be instructed to by the court before they go off to deliberate, is that it is their job to evaluate the character and the veracity of every witness who took that stand. So the other thing is...
And does it add up to first-degree murder,
well, that,
technically speaking, in
right.
terms of the law?
And in fact, you and I were talking over the lunch break of this trial that, you know, jurors are sort of getting this thing piecemeal, in pieces, that the lawyers don't get to as they go along, say, now, ladies and gentlemen, let me kind of pull this together for you. Let me tell you where this is going.
And I did ask him that. I said, you know, it just makes it so much easier if when the defense or the prosecution says whatever, and you don't have to sit there and go, oh, I think that's what they're doing, and they could just tie it in. But your point to that was, well, then you're sort
way.
Of, you know, telling a story versus just getting facts from the witness.
Sure. Now, these witnesses have their thoughts about what it is that expert said about how an officer is to react in that kind of stressful situation, and now they're waiting to hear whether Jason Van Dyke acted in accordance with what that expert said. Now, once again, the lawyers who are coordinating their case, you can be sure that they've worked with Officer Van Dyke, who must tell the truth, to answer questions in a way that will be in accord with or align with what that expert said. They don't want any disparity between the expert saying, this is the kind of reaction we can have in a stressful situation, and then Van Dyke doesn't have that reaction.
And the expert did testify that in his opinion, he believed that Jason Van Dyke, on that fateful evening of October 20th, 2014, perceived a deadly threat and responded to it in a way that is incumbent with his training, which is about neutralizing that potential deadly threat.
Right.
So prosecution did poke some holes, or tried to anyway, saying, well, why, you know, you also talked about the front part of the brain that analyzes things. Why did he jump out of the vehicle and start shooting? Why wasn't there some analyzing going on? But the psychologist at the end of the day talked about the pressure you're under with hormones and everything else racing when he'd already heard on the police scanner that there was this person with a knife who had stabbed at a police car, slashed the windshield, slashed the tires, and these kinds of things coming in created a bigger situation. But he also testified that Jason Van Dyke had said when the psychologist interviewed him that coming up to this, Van Dyke had turned to his partner and said something along the lines of, oh my God, we're going to have to shoot. Why aren't they shooting him, meaning these officers who seem to be under attack from this person with a knife? So there's just a lot going on for the jury to just, as much as people have their opinions and everybody that you talk to, it's just they're either for Van Dyke or against him. It just seems very concrete down the middle. There aren't a lot of well maybes, but yet the jurors are responsible for a well maybe, let's look at both sides, and at the end of the day, follow the law, which might not be completely aligned with your opinion.
Right. Well, there's nobody who's telling us we can't, you know, you get to sit here, not you, but you people get to sit here, have their view of what they think happened, and then hear the testimony of, well, he's lying, or she's telling the truth, or whatever it may be. The only people charged with the duty of not drawing that conclusion are the people sitting on that jury. They're the only ones who have been asked to wait till you've heard all the evidence. It's not an easy thing to do, but jurors essentially can do their job. And
in that sense, we should all be doing that then, rather than just rushing to judgment, because this is a very important case. It's like, listen to every little thing and try to get away from what you originally thought.
It would be a useful thing, but it's just not human nature.
It's not human nature.
You know? I mean, listen, I'm sure you guys get texts and emails from different people who are watching this, who, you know, are raising questions. What about that? Why would he say this? People just, they know what it is they sort of want to happen. And once again, it's perfectly fine. We're just out here watching it. It matters to the people who are inside that courtroom.
Or they think perhaps that we're taking one side or another one. We're just trying to sort of play devil's advocate and say, hey, this is, what about this? And it seems like, oh, at this moment we're on the officer's side, or at this moment we're on the other side. It's just a matter of shedding light and trying to show you how difficult a job this is going to be for jurors if they're just really up to the task of considering it all.
And the jurors are going to be watching. I've been talking about the demeanor of Officer Van Dyke as he goes through this, but the jurors are also going to watch, especially on cross-examination, the demeanor of the prosecutor. Because if he's up there and he's being unfair to the witness, or the juror perceives him as being disrespectful to
too
Officer
combative,
Van Dyke,
maybe?
Too combative, too belligerent, that kind of thing can turn a jury off too. So they shouldn't be judging the perspective of just the lawyer, right? But again, it's all part of the game. It's all part of the overall show.
Which is just hard to take when you realize that as a layperson, so much is at stake. People's lives are riding on this, or the victim's family is getting some sort of justice, or so many things are riding on this. But if we're just, if a juror can be swayed by just the mood that's set, the temperature of the tone, and not see through that to the question and the fact. But again, as you point out, it becomes theater.
Right. Well, and the good news is they're not making a decision today.
Right.
So even if they are having impacts or taking notes on how they feel about different things, we are many days away from where they'll be sitting down to deliberate. We still have Van Dyke should be their last witness. You generally, if you're going to call the defendant, it's your last witness. So after that, there will be, the judge will probably, maybe he'll give him a day off. I don't know what the schedule will be, but he'll give the lawyers time to put their closing arguments together. And we'll have to go through that. And then there's the jury instructions and then the deliberation. So, you know, this could all happen maybe by the end of the week kind of thing. I could see that sort of going in that timeline.
By the way, the reason Officer Van Dyke started testifying and really breaking news, he's taking the stand, but then all of a sudden caught off, and we're understanding some kind of technical difficulty is being dealt with. They've had a number of those at this trial where the video wouldn't roll or the machine wouldn't work right, yeah, or the court reporter couldn't type. Yeah, so we don't know what it is exactly, but we are going to go back in as soon as they're ready, because obviously we don't want to miss a second of what Officer Van Dyke has to say about all of this.
And you've got, just to make this point, I don't know what the technicality is right now, but they got to get it right. Because if there's an issue of, if the court reporter machine isn't working, or if there's something like that where there's a, where something that is part of the record, the judge especially, more than anybody, the judge is very careful, but he knows that there's a record being created that one day, if Officer Van Dyke is convicted, will go up to an appellate court. I think we probably have pretty intelligent jurors who understand that if he's acquitted, that's the end of this case. Prosecutors don't get to retry it.
No double jeopardy.
There's
on the
no double
thing.
Jeopardy. It's all over. But if he's convicted, then you can be sure his lawyers will be creating a case going up on appeal. So the last thing the judge wants is for an appellate court to look and say, ah, well, this was error. Well, the judge shouldn't have done this, shouldn't have ruled this way, shouldn't have allowed things to proceed while this technical issue was going on. That, so that's why the judge is very careful.
Some of the jurors could have missed whatever when this technical thing was happening.
Exactly. So the judge has to be very careful. That's where the judge's head is. The last thing he wants is to get reversed by an appellate court or a court beyond that. So that's why we take these stops to get it right. The judge calls everybody up. Everybody's in on there. They all know what's going on. When I say all, the lawyers all know what's going on. They're all part of this process. And the judge needs to get that record right.
And this is the other thing. This is the first time now we're hearing from Jason Van Dyke truly in terms of this case. So this is why this is huge right now that he's on the witness stand. He did not speak for basically almost 3 years. The video, the killing happened in 2014. A year later, 2015, the video, police dash cam comes out. Really seems to help the prosecution more in terms of the angle you're seeing, and it looks like the teen is just gunned down, moving away from officers. In this trial, we've seen a recreation, a 3D recreation that uses technology and science.
By the defense
team. By the defense team to turn it around, the angle. Prosecution didn't contest the science used, so that you can get a different angle. And in that particular angle, it looks like the teen is closing the distance with the officer, not dropping the knife. So there's that. But the prosecution, in terms of the officer himself, we have not really heard from him other than a couple recent interviews he gave under very tight conditions and was basically violating a gag order to some degree. But his defense was he didn't talk about the shooting itself. It was more about his own fears and his life, sort of the emotional side of things.
Yeah.
But this is going to be more factual because the defense might allow him some leeway in how they're answering. The judge might not. And then the prosecution's going to get in there and try to rip a hole into whatever he says. So this is the first time we're really hearing from Jason Van Dyke once he starts talking about this.
And you're right about those interviews he gave to the newspapers. There was a lot of controversy about that. And it'll be interesting to see whether his lawyers go there and say, why did you do this? You know, why did you go?
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, because we may find out that or learn that he did it really against the advice of his lawyers, or maybe they knew he was going to do it. Not sure. But they may go there. And then if they do go there, well, of course, that now opens up the door for the prosecution to begin to challenge his motives on why he set you. Were you trying to taint the jury? We're trying to reach people who would actually sit on your jury and sit in judgment and get word to them before they ever walked into a courtroom. That's the kind of thing. So that's why the defense lawyer has to be a little careful about what doors he opens. Mm. Because when you open a door, the prosecution gets to walk in with you.
They are bringing everybody back into court. Not sure where they are right at this second. So I'm waiting to hear from our control room. They are bringing the jury in right now, so and we obviously cannot show the jurors. That's part of this. We're not showing the jury. The judge doesn't want to be seen, but it is Vincent Van Gaughn. You can look up what he looks like if you'd like, and he's a tough judge.
And by the way, he is a tough judge, but a fair judge. He's no nonsense. We got that from day one, right? He just moments where he would say, you know, counsel, sit down. You know, he just...
Oh, today a reporter was hauled out for recording something.
Yeah.
So he was arrested, taken out, you know, violation.
Well, that's a pretty bad... everybody knows. In fact, by the way, you're not supposed to be recording things in that courtroom. Or in any courtroom.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that.
Okay, going back in now, let's listen as Jason Van Dyke continues.
We are first entering into, so there would be a delay on the TVs as Mr. Van Dyke testifies live. There would be a delay out there, so we're just going to cut them off and end the confusion. All right, thank you.
Okay.
good? Mike? Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Ruger, proceed.
Could I have the court reporter read back my last question, please?
Sure. Denise?
Question. Did you have the occasion to go to another district after that?
You can answer that question.
I went to the 7th District, which is located at 61st and Racine.
And what were your duties and responsibilities at the 7th District?
I was a patrol officer.
And how long were you at the 7th District?
I was there for a few months.
Now, the 7th District, you said, was at 61st and what?
Racine.
Is that the Englewood District?
I'm sorry?
Is that the Englewood District?
Yes, it is.
All right. And where'd you go after you left the Englewood District?
I was asked to go to the targeted response unit.
And explain to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury what the targeted response area or unit is.
It's a unit made up of essentially 10-man teams, and you were assigned at the discretion of the department to go to high crime areas, and you were responsible for crime suppression, targeting gang members and gang activity.
And how long are you in that unit?
Almost since the start of its inception until it was disbanded.
When was it disbanded?
Under Gary McCarthy.
Okay. Where did you go after it was disbanded?
I went to the Area Central Saturation Team and the Area South Saturation Team.
And where's Area Central?
51st and Wentworth.
And you say you were on a saturation team. Explain what you did on a saturation team.
Essentially the same duties as in Area Central, Area 1. You're sent out to one of the various districts within the area at the discretion of the deputy chief. Usually they were, again, targeting gangs and gang activity.
And then you went to Area 2, is that right?
Yeah, Area South, which was formerly known as Area 2.
And where is that located?
727 East 111th Street.
And you had the same duties and responsibilities down there?
Yes, only it was the far south side of the city.
Okay. And where did you go after that?
After that, I went to the back to the 7th District.
And how long were you in the 7th District the second time?
A few months.
And where did you go from the 7th District?
And after there, I went to the 8th District at 3420 West 63rd Street.
All right. Now, in all those years from 2001, and when did you go to the 8th District? I'm sorry.
January of 2014.
All right. So from 2001 to 2014, you worked in various jobs in the Chicago Police Department. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Did you ever have occasion to arrest or be involved with people who had guns?
Several.
Then did you ever have occasion to be involved with people who had knives?
Yes.
Did you ever have occasion to draw your gun?
Unfortunately, I've had to.
And how many times did you say you had to draw your gun?
I don't know.
Would it be more than 10?
Yes.
More than 20?
Probably.
At any time from 2001 until October 20th, 2014, did you ever fire your weapon?
Objection, Judge.
Overruled. I'll allow you wide latitude on cross-examination.
No, and I'm very proud of that.
All right. Now, I want to direct your attention to October 20th, 2014. Did you work the night before that?
No, I did not.
Did you work on October 18th?
No.
So you had a couple days off before you started work on October 20th, is that correct?
That's correct.
And tell us what you did when you got up that morning.
Got up that morning with my kids, made sure they were changed, ready to go to school. They had breakfast and made sure they got to school.
All right. And what did you do after they left for school?
Did some household chores.
And did you have a part-time job at the time?
I did.
Did you go to that part-time job that day?
Yes.
What time did you go there?
Roughly noon to 4.
And where was that?
It was at the Walmart in Cicero, Illinois.
And you were just working security there, is that right?
Yes.
All right. So when you left there at 4 o'clock, where did you go?
Went back home, had some dinner.
And did you have occasion to take a nap or anything like that?
Yeah, I took a nap right before work.
All right. So what time did you go to the district?
About 9 p.m.
And that's when you had to start work that night, is that right?
That's correct.
And where's the first place you went when you got to the district?
Went to the locker room and changed.
And did you have occasion to go to roll call?
Yes, I did.
Who were you going to work with that night?
Officer Joe Walsh.
And had you worked with Joe Walsh in the past?
One time prior.
All right. So this is the second time you're going to work with Mr. Walsh?
Yes, it is.
You went to roll call, is that right?
Yes.
And after roll call, where did you go?
Went to the 7-Eleven.
No, but you got your car, right?
Yes.
Who was driving the car?
Excuse me, Officer Walsh.
And you left the district and went to the 7-Eleven first, is that right?
Yes.
All right. And what time do you think you got to the 7-Eleven?
Probably around quarter to the hour.
All right. Did you have, and you left the 7-Eleven, right?
Yes.
Did you hear, now, you're wearing a radio on your person, is that right?
Yes.
And Mr. Walsh, Officer Walsh, is wearing a radio on his person as well?
Yes.
Did you receive any radio traffic as you were either leaving the 7-Eleven or had just left the 7-Eleven?
I heard 815 Robert calling in a call of distress.
All right. And what did you and your officer, and Officer Walsh, do when you heard that radio transmission?
We responded. We were a rapid response car. Our duties were to go to any in-progress calls with also being called for, you know, officers asking for assistance.
Where was the 7-Eleven?
59th and Pulaski on the southwest corner.
All right, so you were going in response to some call for help, is that right?
Yes.
And so you got in your car?
Correct.
Officer Walsh is driving?
That's correct.
Which direction did you go?
Northbound.
On what?
Pulaski.
All right. Do you know if your lights and sirens are going at that time?
I don't remember.
Fine. Did you hear any radio traffic on the way to, well, strike that. Were you headed north on Pulaski?
That's correct.
And do you know that, were you going to 40th Street in Pulaski, or do you know?
Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah. Were you going to 40th and Pulaski, or do you know at that point?
I don't remember if while we were heading into the car, Joe told me, or while we were in the car. I didn't hear where exactly their call of assignment was. Fine. I don't remember.
And on the way up north on Pulaski, did you hear any other radio traffic?
Yes.
What did you hear?
I heard 815 Roberts saying that their tire had been slashed.
Do you know if you turned on your lights and sirens at that point?
I know at that point they were definitely activated because I remember the sirens.
And did you know at that point where you were headed?
Yes.
Where were you headed?
We were heading to 40th and Carlo?
Carlo?
Carlo. It was one of the K streets. I can't say which one.
And just so the jury understands, those streets are just west of Pulaski. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. Did you have occasion to get to the intersection of 40th and Pulaski?
Yes, I did.
And what happened when you got to that intersection?
At 40th and Pulaski, we made a left-hand turn. We would have been going westbound.
Right. Did you have occasion to see anyone on the street at that point?
Yes.
Who did you see? What did you see?
To the right, I saw a man next to a car. He was pointing a little bit further west and south from his location.
And when you say pointing, he was like this?
He was feverishly pointing.
Okay. Did you look in the direction he was pointing?
I did.
What, if anything, did you see when you looked in that direction?
I saw Officer McElligott pointing eastbound. While he was running eastbound, and while he was pointing, he had his gun in his hand.
And did you know Officer McGilligut from the past?
Yes.
All right. So you knew Officer McGilligut when you saw him, right?
I did.
And you say he had his gun out?
He did.
Did you see a squad car?
Yes.
Where was the squad car in relation to Officer McGilligut?
Almost immediately near him.
Did you notice anything unusual about the squad car?
Well, it was moving. The right side, it was hopping, like it was limping, I guess you could say.
Okay. Did you see, you say Officer McGilligut was pointing at something or somewhere?
Yes.
Which way was he pointing?
He was pointing directly in front of him, further east in front of him.
All right. And did you look in that direction?
I did.
What if anything did you see when you looked in that direction?
I saw a male black in front of him wearing a black hoodie and blue jeans running. And in his right hand, I saw a knife.
And can you describe the area where he was running for his police?
He was entering into a parking lot.
And the parking lot was parking lot of what business?
Burger King.
Now, what did Officer Walsh is still driving the car, right?
That's correct.
What did he do when, did you point out to Officer Walsh, I see this guy running in the parking lot?
No, he pointed him out.
Okay. Did he then drive the, where did he drive the squad car?
We entered into the parking lot and drove on a southeast angle towards the entrance of the Burger King.
And what was the point of doing that?
To prevent the male black in a black hoodie and blue jeans with a knife from entering into the Burger King.
Were you able to prevent him from entering into the Burger King?
Yes, we were.
Did you see where he went after he left the area of the Burger King?
He ran onto Pulaski Avenue. He ran further eastbound onto Pulaski Avenue.
All right. And what did you and Officer Walsh do?
We looked for a safe, well, not a safe opening, but an opening where we could hop the curb and cross onto Pulaski and further chase after him.
So were you able to get across the curb onto Pulaski?
Yes.
In which direction did you start going when you got on Pulaski?
We started to go southbound on Pulaski in the northbound lanes, and at that time he didn't, the male black in the black hoodie and blue jeans, he didn't have a knife in his hand anymore.
All right. So when you got on the Pulaski, you saw the male black again, right?
That's correct.
And you didn't see a knife in his hand at that point?
That's correct.
What did you think at that point?
I said he doesn't have the knife anymore.
Were you relieved?
Greatly relieved.
Did your car continue to go southbound on Pulaski?
Yes.
And did you notice anything coming northbound on Pulaski as you're driving that way?
Yeah, we saw another squad car approaching us.
All right. As you approached that other squad car, did you do anything inside of your car?
Yes.
What was that?
I started to open up my car door because I thought we were going to be able to knock him to the ground with the car door.
When you say knock him to the ground, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about the male black with the black hoodie and blue jeans.
And were you able to knock him to the ground with the car?
No, the other car was coming at us way too quickly, and we had to get out of its way.
And did Officer Walsh say something to you at that point?
Yes.
What did he say?
He either told me to stay in the car or close my door. I don't remember which one it was.
So then you had to drive around the squad car that's coming north. Is that right?
That's correct.
Did you lose sight of the guy with the hoodie and the blue jeans and strike it? You now know that the person with the hoodie and the blue jeans was Laquan McDonald. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. So when you drove around the squad car that's coming north, did you lose sight of Laquan McDonald at that point?
Yes, I did.
And for how long did you lose sight of him?
Moments.
Were you able to get back onto... you never left Pulaski, right?
That's correct.
So you were able to get around the other car coming north?
Yeah, the other car kept on driving north, and I think we kept on driving south for about 5 car lengths, maybe.
All right, so the other squad car did not stop for Laquan McDonald, right?
No.
As you got around that other squad car, could you then see Laquan McDonald again?
Yes.
All right. What were you trying to do at that point when you got around that other squad car?
We're trying to keep him from continuing heading eastbound on that southeast angle and to enter into another business.
What was the other business?
The other business was a Dunkin' Donuts.
So you're trying to block him from the Dunkin' Donuts as well, correct?
Correct.
And did Officer Walsh, did he eventually park the car?
He did. He parked it on a southwest angle, straddling the lines.
And was that right in front of the Dunkin' Donuts?
I believe so, yes.
As you were driving around that car before you parked, were you looking back at Laquan McDonald?
Yeah, I was looking at him over my right shoulder.
And at any point did you see him?
Objection, maybe.
At this time, you passed preliminaries, Mr. Ruber. Stop leaving. Sustained.
What, if anything, did you see Laquan McDonald do as you're driving around?
He kept on coming towards us.
Right. Before you parked, did you see him do anything?
Well, no.
Okay. So, Officer Walsh parked the car. What did you do?
I immediately got out of the car.
And did you see Laquan McDonald when you got out of the car?
Yes. While he was exiting the car, I could.
All right. Did you see anything in his hands?
Yes.
What did you see?
I saw him extend out a knife, flicking it towards the side.
And how far away from you was Laquan McDonald when he flipped out that knife?
It's probably about 20 feet.
All right. Is that closer than you thought you'd be?
Objection, maybe.
All right, really, at this time, stop leaving.
Do you know where Officer Walsh went when you got out of the car?
No, I don't.
So you don't know if he was behind you or where he was, right?
No, I lost focus of him. I was focusing on Laquan McDonald.
Could you see anything else other than Laquan McDonald?
I saw another squad car approaching from the north at us, and I saw an empty field to my left.
What was Laquan McDonald doing?
Advancing on me.
And could you see him, his face?
Yeah, I could. I won't
forget it. What, if anything, did you notice about his face?
His face had no expression. His eyes were just bugging out of his head. He had just these huge white eyes just staring right through me.
And did you say anything to Laquan McDonald?
I was yelling at him, drop the knife. I yelled, I don't know how many times, but that's all I yelled.
And did he keep advancing toward you?
He never stopped.
How close did he get to you?
About 10 to 15 feet away from me.
And when he got 10 to 15 feet away from me, what did he do?
We never lost eye contact. His eyes were bugged out. His face was just expressionless and turned his torso towards me.
And what, if anything, did he do with his arm?
He waved the knife from his lower right side upwards, across his body, towards my left shoulder.
And when he did that, what did you do, officer?
I shot him.
And when you say you shot him, do you know if you actually hit him or not?
Objection, maybe.
Not really. No. Overall.
I'm sorry?
Do you know if you actually hit him or not when you shot him?
I have no idea. I didn't know at the time.
All right. Do you know how many shots you fired?
No.
What happened when you started shooting?
I'm sorry?
What happened when you started shooting?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please?
Sure. You all right?
Yeah.
What happened when you started shooting? What happened to Laquan McDonald when you started shooting?
Eventually, he fell to the ground.
Did he ever drop that knife?
No.
After you realized that he fell to the ground, did you stop shooting?
Once I recognized that he was on the ground, I stopped shooting.
And what did you do when you stopped shooting?
I stopped shooting. I put my gun down.
Can you stand up and show the jury what you did, please?
Initially, I was like this. I put my gun down to maybe a 45-degree position. And I started to approach while yelling at him, drop that knife.
All right. He still hadn't dropped the knife, is that right?
No, he did not.
And when he was on the ground, what, if anything, did you observe about him while he was on the ground?
All I could see, you know, I could see. See him starting to push up with his left hand off the ground. I see his left shoulder start to come up, and I still see him holding that knife with his right hand, not letting go of it. And his eyes are still bugged out. His face has got no expression on it.
During that time on the ground, did you say anything to him?
I'm yelling at him, drop that knife.
How many times do you think?
I couldn't tell you.
And he never dropped it, right?
He never dropped it.
So, when you saw him move like that, what did you do?
I just kept on looking at the knife, and I shot at it. I just wanted him to get rid of that knife. I
Did you also want him to stay on the ground?
Mr. Rooker, stop.
Right, you say you shot at the knife, right?
Yeah.
What else? Why else did you shoot at him on the ground?
I wanted him to stay on the ground because it was going to be an easier position for us to take him into custody.
And explain your gun to us. People talk about a slide lock. What does a slide lock mean?
Slide lock means the gun is locked backwards, the gun meaning the actual slide that cycles the cartridges up from the magazine, and when there's no bullets left in the magazine, it automatically locks back. You could say violently locks back to let you know that it's out of ammunition.
Did you know how many shots you shot until that slide lock locked?
No.
So when the slide lock locked, what did that indicate to you?
That the gun was empty.
And what did you do when the slide lock locked?
I ejected the magazine from the gun, and I reloaded the weapon as I was trained.
You were trained to reload the weapon?
Yes.
Did Officer Walsh say anything to you at that point?
He said, Jason, I got this.
Was Officer Walsh armed?
Yes.
Did he have his gun out?
He had his gun on Laquan McDonald on his approach.
Was Officer Walsh able to kick the knife away from Laquan McDonald?
Yeah, he kicked that knife probably as hard as he could. It only went a couple of feet.
And after that, what did you do?
I screamed into the radio, we need an ambulance.
Okay. Take as much time as you need.
Very emotional testimony from Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. What are the jurors thinking? Do they believe him in his account of what happened that fateful night when he fatally shot Laquan McDonald?
How many shots did you think you shot that second time?
I think I fired two or three shots.
Thank you, Jason. I definitely.
Ms. Gleason.
Sure. I don't know if it was the facts the way it's supposed to be, or if it's just...
Are they ready to go, Mike? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're just going to take a couple minutes, so there'll be a short recess while we get them hooked up.
All rise for the jury.
So a short recess right now while they're kind of getting things ready for the prosecution to cross-examine Officer Van Dyke. If you have been following this, first of all, we didn't even know if he would be testifying in his own defense. Didn't know if it would be today. And then suddenly after lunch, here he is on the stand, very composed at first, going through his training, how he came to be in the police department, how he worked in difficult areas such as the Englewood area, high crime area, was part of target response unit that went into gang areas and targeted gang activity, has been a lot of his training, has always had a gun, had sometimes numerous times had to draw that gun, he stated, but he was proud that he had never in his time from 2001 until 2014 fired his weapon, and he said it was something he was very proud of. But unfortunately on that fateful night of October 20th, 2014, he went through what he went through coming up to that scene, and at times, right when he had to admit he shot Laquan McDonald and some of the other things, he started voice shaking, tearing up. Let's listen.
Jason.
Actually, this is, they fooled even me. This is video from earlier. I thought they were back, because sometimes they do come back, and it's on a split-second notice. But at any rate, this is Officer Van Dyke on the stand, as he testified earlier, being questioned by his own attorney, one of his own attorneys on the defense side of things. When they come back from recess, the prosecution will get his shot to try to undermine his testimony. But he really talked about how he perceived the situation from his mind, that he'd heard the radio traffic coming on duty that night, about officers needed assistance, that there was somebody who had slashed a police squad car, slashed the tires, done some damage, and so they were rushing to the scene. And he says that when he and his partner that night, who had only worked with one time before, Officer Joe Walsh, started coming onto the scene there at about roughly 40th and Pulaski, that they saw the suspect, which he described as a black male, black hoodie, blue jeans, had a knife in hand and was running, and he saw an officer following him on foot who kept pointing in his direction, and a disabled police car that appeared to be sort of hobbling, driving behind, which we now know was the car that had its tire slashed. So he and Walsh took off then, and as they saw, they said, the male black entering the Burger King parking lot, they flew into that parking lot of their vehicle to block his access from entering the Burger King. Then they say the suspect ran onto Pulaski Avenue, and where they again looked for a place to jump the curb to get out there in Pulaski and follow. Once they did, they were heading the wrong way down the street. They thought to open their car door and try to bump him down, but then a car was heading their direction. They were on the wrong side, so to avoid an accident, they had to get out of the way for that. He said at that point they were getting in front of the Dunkin' Donuts and then had the same fear about this armed male getting into the Dunkin' Donuts, and so they tried to block him, jumped out of the vehicle, and as we know, it was within 6 seconds that Officer Van Dyke started firing. But in this part where the defense started questioning him, he first of all admitted then right prior to this, where he'd still seen Laquan McDonald in the distance, he didn't see the knife anymore, and they asked him, well, how did you feel about that? He says, I was greatly relieved. But then he lost sight of him momentarily when this business happened with the other police car, and they had to quickly avoid each other. He said he lost view of McDonald for a moment. Then they saw him, wanted to block him from the Dunkin' Donuts, and it was then that he saw the knife again. He jumped out of the vehicle, saw the knife in his hand, says that he motioned with the knife across his arm, shoulder, and looked at him, he said, with just a blank stare, as if he was looking right through him, dead eyes. And at this point, in there somewhere is where Van Dyke started his throat started choking up a bit, and when was asked what he was doing, he said, like McDonald just kept coming towards him, extending that knife, and Officer Van Dyke just went ahead and shot him, said he shot him, and then he started tearing up, wiped his eyes at one point, and just said that's what he had been trained to do, waited for a moment when the suspect was on the ground, but said he wouldn't let go of the knife, tried to shoot at the knife, and kept yelling, drop the knife, drop the knife, but said it wasn't going anywhere, and he just kept firing again, and that's when he realized the weapon was out of bullets, and as he was trained to do, he ejected the cartridge, was putting another one in, and that's when his partner said, Jason, I've got this, and he said his partner also did have his weapon out and drawn, and then he kicked the knife away from Laquan McDonald. And what did he do next? He said he got on the radio and immediately screamed, we need an ambulance, which he screamed into the radio. And that's how he left it, pretty much. But now the jury's currently being brought in, so it's going to be up to the prosecution now to try to see if there's any way that it will try to hammer away at this and take some of this away, because what we started out with was incriminating police dash cam video, but the defense has tried to counter in many ways that from the officer's perspective, this was a matter of self-protection. So let's listen.
Are they up about to his waist level? That's your testimony?
No.
What is your testimony? Why did you shoot him?
With his actions with the knife or his actions in total?
His actions with the knife.
Well, his actions with the knife also were his actions in advancing on me. He brought the knife down from his waist level up towards his left shoulder like this.
Okay, and you were interviewed that night by Detective March, isn't that correct?
Yes.
And that night when you were interviewed by Detective March, you told him, isn't it correct, that McDonald raised the knife across his chest and over his shoulder, pointing the knife at you, correct?
I'm sorry?
Did you tell that to Officer March when you were interviewed that night?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
Okay. You told Officer March when you were interviewed that night that McDonald raised the knife across his chest, over his shoulder, and pointed the knife at you, correct?
You know, I don't remember exactly what I said immediately after the shooting. I do remember talking to Detective March. I remember telling him what I just demonstrated to you.
So you never told him that that Laquan brought the knife over his shoulder and pointed it to you. Is that what you're saying?
Again, I don't remember exactly what I said immediately after the shooting. I was still in shock.
And you told that to Dr. Miller when Dr. Miller interviewed you, didn't you?
What did I tell him?
You told him that he brought the knife up over and across his chest and was pointing it at you?
I told Dr. Miller that he brought it up across his chest like this, yes.
Okay. Now, you've sat here for several days. Where do you see that on the video?
I don't see a video.
You've sat here for several days and watched several videos, haven't you?
Yes.
Have you ever seen Laquan McDonald do that on one of those videos?
The video doesn't show my perspective.
The video doesn't. How about the animation? Let's play that. The animation that has shown, Your Honor, what's been previously entered as defense exhibit number 10. We're going to skip to your perspective. There's your perspective, right? Is that it? You want me to play it again?
No, it's not my perspective because it's showing the back of my head and not from my eye level. It's not showing what I saw. It's showing the back of my head and above me.
Okay,
so it's not my perspectiveness.
Let me ask you this. It says officer view on that, and that's what your expert presented as your view. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, miss?
That's what your expert presented as your view?
That's beyond my...
Were you sitting here the last couple of days when your expert testified?
I was here, yes.
Okay. And he testified that this was from your viewpoint, correct?
I don't know.
And do you see it in that video at all, Laquan McDonald raising the knife?
No, I don't.
And in this particular video, it stops right there, right? When he falls to the ground? Right?
I don't see the video anymore. It disappeared, miss.
Okay. When you watch the video in court, your animation, it stops once Laquan falls to the ground, correct?
I'm going to take your word for it.
You didn't watch it?
All right, play it again then.
Let's play it. Again, this is defense exhibit number 10. Right there, correct?
It's still going.
Well, this is just playing it over and over because it doesn't stop unless you stop, right? On your animation, did you ever see anything that happened after Laquan fell to the ground?
If that's your objection, overrule.
I didn't see the video stop, so I don't know where it's supposed to stop.
Okay. So, and it's your testimony as you sit here today that you you made a decision to stop shooting?
I'm sorry, I don't understand you, miss. Could you repeat that or rephrase it?
Sure. Did you ever make a decision to stop shooting that night?
Yes, I did.
And when was that?
Once I recognized that he hit the ground.
Well, he hit the ground and you continued to shoot, correct?
Approach, yes.
And so you're walking closer to him as you continue to shoot him?
I don't understand you.
Well, you just said on your approach. So as you're approaching him while he's on the ground, you're continuing to shoot him?
No, I think you're putting words into my mouth. I'm trying to answer your question, miss, so please let me answer it. After I reassessed the situation, I did fire after that. Yes, I did.
You reassessed. When was it that you reassessed?
After I lowered my weapon.
When did that happen in the scheme of what happened at night? When did you lower your weapon?
After I recognized the fact that he fell to the ground. Weapon. After reassessing the situation, that would have been it.
And then you continued the shooting after that?
I shot at that knife. I wanted him to get rid of that knife.
Okay. Let's talk about the knife. You're not trained as a police officer to shoot at somebody's knife, are you?
No, you're not.
You're trained to shoot at center mass, correct?
Yes.
So why would you continue to shoot at his knife? That's not what you're trained to do.
My focus was just on that knife, and I just wanted him to get rid of that knife. That's all I could think.
Marked as people's number 8, which is the video. you see that on the screen?
Yes, ma'am.
Does it show Ron McDonald trying to get up?
I can't tell you. It's not in front of me.
Well, you just saw the video. Was there any point in that video where Laquan McDonald was trying to get up?
In that video, I may not show it, but that wasn't from my perspective, ma'am. I was coming at a completely different angle.
And you told Detective March that night that you continued to shoot at him once he was on the ground because he was pointing the knife at you. Is that correct?
No, I'm sorry. I don't remember exactly what I said immediately after the shooting to the detective. I was still in shock. I know I gave him a summary of what happened that night.
You don't recall that you told him that you continued to fire your weapon at McDonald, who was on the ground, as McDonald appeared to be attempting to get up, all the while continuing to point the knife at you.
I'm sorry, I said this to the detective?
Yes.
Again, I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly what I said to the detective immediately after the shooting. I was in shock.
What you said to Detective Walsh on the way there. Oh my God, we're going to have to shoot the guy. Why'd you say that?
I didn't talk to a Dr. Walsh.
A Detective Walsh.
Officer Walsh, ma'am.
Officer Walsh?
Yes.
Okay. Why'd you say to him, oh my God, we're going to have to shoot the guy?
I thought the officers were under attack.
Okay, at the point that you thought...
Ma'am, I'm still trying to answer. I thought he was under attack and the whole thing was just, it was shocking to me.
Shocking? You've responded to several calls over your years of people with knives, correct?
I've encountered a few, yes.
And the only thing that you knew at that point was that they had called in, popped a tire, and somebody had a knife, correct?
I had heard over the radio that he had slashed the tire, yes.
It doesn't, over the radio never says slash the tire, does it?
I now know that, yes. I misinterpreted it at the time.
Okay, so, but what you heard was pop the tire, right?
At the time, I thought I heard slashed.
And when you see McElliott and Daphne in the Burger King parking lot, you know they're not under attack, correct?
I didn't see them in the parking lot.
You didn't see them in the parking lot at Burger King?
I saw them before they entered the parking lot.
Okay, so you never see McElliott chasing Laquan across the parking lot at Burger King?
I think I see McElliott chasing him on the sidewalk.
Which sidewalk is that?
The one that he was on.
Well, where? Before the Burger King or after the Burger King?
What do you mean before or after? Before the entrance of the Burger King or at the Burger King?
On
Pulaski?
Okay, let me ask a different question. Maybe you'll understand this one. You pull into the Burger King parking lot, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And when you pull into the Burger King parking lot, do you see McElliott chasing Laquan?
No, we saw him before pulling into the lot.
So you did you see Laquan running across the Burger King parking lot?
Yeah, he was about good 10 strides in front of McElligott. He was outstretched pretty good.
Okay, so you did see McElligott chasing him, correct?
Yeah, he was behind him.
Okay, so he wasn't under attack, was he?
At that point, no.
And Gaffney was actually in his vehicle, correct?
All I saw was a squad car. I didn't know who was in that car.
Okay, so before that night, you didn't know McElligott and Gaffney were partners in that squad?
I knew that, yes.
Okay, so when you hear over the radio, it's Gaffney calling in, correct?
I don't know. I don't know who was calling it in.
And did you hear the voices when they were calling it in?
Oh, yeah, I heard the radio, yes.
And so you didn't recognize the voice?
It's the radio, it can be very hard to pick up on whose voice is whose, so no, I couldn't tell you who was calling in the transmission.
Okay, so did you think it was some other officer in that squad car besides Gaffney?
Are you saying I'm just imagining another officer driving the car?
I'm asking you. You said you didn't know it was Gaffney, right? In the squad car?
I couldn't. At that time, I didn't even know if that was Gaffney and McElligott's squad car.
But it was one thing, you said.
Right, it was a police car, yes.
And then Laquan actually is running in front of you and Walsh, correct?
Where?
In the Burger King lot.
For a little bit of time, yes.
And he actually runs in front of you and across his glass, yes?
At what point, yeah, he crosses in front of us, yes.
And then it's your testimony as you sit here today that you open that car door because you're going to knock him out of the way?
No, that's not my testimony.
That wasn't what you said on direct, that you were going to use the car door to knock Laquan down?
Yeah, you just rephrased it.
Okay. So it's your testimony as you sit here today that you were going to open that door to knock him down. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And again, when you talked to Detective March that night after the shooting, isn't it correct that you told Detective March that you opened the right front door of the vehicle to exit and confront McDonald, but Walsh told you to stay in the vehicle as they were too close?
I don't remember exactly what I told him. I was under a lot of stress right immediately after shooting, ma'am.
Did you ever tell that to Dr. Miller that you were attempting to open the door to knock him down?
My conversation with Dr. Miller, I don't remember. That was a couple years ago.
And at this point, then, Walsh is the one who pulls up around the other squad, correct?
Yes, he was driving that night.
And you, when the vehicle stops, you jump out, correct?
I opened up the car door and I got out of the car, yes.
And at that point, you watched Laquan McDonald for 6 seconds before you fired that first shot, correct?
At the time of the incident, I don't know how long it was.
Well, you know now as you sit here and you've watched the video over and over, correct? It's 6 seconds.
I'll take your word for it. I didn't count it. It's too difficult.
And is that the time that you saw his bugged out eyes?
Saw his eyes.
Is that the first time?
I can't answer that for certainty.
Well, when else would you have seen his face?
When he got closer to me.
And when, well, that's during that 6 seconds, correct?
Yes.
And during those 6 seconds, not only is he getting closer to you, but you're getting closer to him, correct?
I now know that, yeah, I took a couple steps towards him, yeah.
Well, it took more than a couple of steps because you go all the way out past your squad car, correct? The end of your squad car?
I'm not sure.
And do you recall you telling Detective March that night that when you got out, you backpedaled? Do you recall telling him that?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what I said. I was under...
So you never did backpedal, did you?
I'm trying to answer. Which question do you want me to answer, ma'am? You asked me two questions. I'm trying to answer them one at a time.
Okay. Do you recall telling Detective March that if LaShawn McDonald came towards you, you backpedaled?
Yeah, I thought at that night that I had moved backwards. But after seeing the video countless times, I know I didn't backpedal.
And you also told that to Dr. Miller, didn't you, that you backpedaled?
Sorry, I don't remember the discussion of 2 years ago with my conversation with Dr. Miller.
Well, your conversation with Dr. Miller was to tell Dr. Miller what it was that you saw that night, correct?
Yes.
So that he can make some kind of an assessment of, or give an opinion here in court, correct?
At the time of speaking to Dr. Miller, I didn't know what the purpose was. I didn't know if it was for an expert witness or to get me some help.
And so when you got out of that car that night, not only is Laquan approaching towards the fence, you're also approaching him, correct?
He wasn't approaching towards the fence, ma'am.
He wasn't going towards the fence?
No.
Have you seen the video that we've been playing here in court?
I have.
I'm going to play again part of People's Number 8.
Yes, ma'am.
You open the door?
No.
Right there?
On the screen, yeah, that's where I opened my door.
And it's your testimony today that you were opening the door because you thought you could knock me down?
Yes.
That he's not walking towards a fence?
I'm sorry?
It's your testimony that he's not walking towards a fence?
That's my testimony. It looks to me like he's going from one side of the dotted line to the other side of the dotted line.
No. And it's right there at that point where you say that he raised his arm up around his chest?
At this exact point?
Yes.
No, I don't know.
Now, you had a radio on that night, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You knew a taser car had been... Correct?
Yes.
You know, taser had somebody had responded that they were coming, correct?
I just heard that a car had responded. They were coming from a distance, but I never heard once over the radio that a taser unit was responding.
Well, I believe the dispatch actually says when they're on the radio, they say that they're near Mulligan and Archer, correct?
I don't remember the exact cross streets, no.
And then the dispatcher comes on and says, anybody closer with the taser, right?
I don't remember.
And so when you got out of that car that night, you could have called and said, hey, where's the person with the taser, right?
Hypothetically, you could.
Well, it's not a hypothetical question. You could have called and said, where's the car with the taser, right?
I'm sorry, what's your objection?
It is a hypothetical question. You could have called. It's hypothetical.
Overrule.
Hypothetically, anybody on scene could have called.
No, the question is you. You could have called, correct?
It was a very chaotic moment.
The answer is a yes or no.
And I'm trying, it doesn't just stipulate a yes or no answer. It's a very complicated answer. There's a lot going on at that moment.
You didn't even have to get out of the car at that point, did you?
You could say I also didn't have to go to work that night.
No, that wasn't the question. The question was you didn't even have to go get out of the car, correct?
As an officer, you have a duty to not retreat. You have a duty to place somebody into custody.
Well, and you also have a duty to make sure that you protect yourself, right?
Yes.
And you never did anything to put any kind of barrier between you and Laquan McDonald, did you?
It was a tactfully unsound spot, and there was no time to look for any barrier. If I had backed up, I would have backed up against the wall.
What wall?
Would have been like the squad car. You would have pinned yourself up against the wall. I'm just using it as a phrase.
Well, you actually went to the end of your squad car, right?
I know that now, yes.
Could have went back around your squad car, so the car was between you and the front, correct?
There was no time for that.
Well, you had 6 seconds before you pulled the trigger the first time, right?
And in that 6 seconds, he got a lot closer to me than I ever could have gone away from him around the squad car.
And you got a lot closer to him, too, didn't you?
I know that now, yeah. Not intentionally.
Pardon?
Not intentionally.
Not intentionally?
Well, I thought I was backpedaling that night.
What?
Miss, I thought I was backpedaling that night.
You thought you were backpedaling as you're firing shot after shot after shot?
What I know now and what I thought at that time are two different things.
Now, you didn't know anything at all about Laquan McDonald that night, did you?
Just from the actions I observed of him and his actions that I heard before seeing him.
That's all, right?
Yeah, I don't think I ever met him before.
Now, you stopped shooting because your gun was empty, correct? It wasn't because you thought the threat was over with, right?
I'm sorry.
It wasn't because you thought the threat was over with, right?
Between the time I stopped shooting and the time I reloaded, the situation had drastically changed.
Really? What changed?
No longer a threat by the time I reloaded my weapon and brought it up to the ready position.
Why wasn't he?
In those couple of seconds, he did stop moving.
And it's actually your partner who said, hey, I got this, right? You're ready to continue to shoot him.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not? Your partner didn't tell you, hey, Jason, I got this?
You asked me a compound question. I was asking the second part of the question.
Okay.
He did say, he did say, Jason, I got this.
Judge, can I have a moment, please?
Sure. Squad car, Laquan McDonald was walking toward you, right?
Yes.
If that's your objection on redirect, overrule. Go ahead and proceed.
If I'm walking towards you and I step over this car, am I still walking toward you?
Yes, you are.
Did he ever turn and walk toward that fence?
His back never once turned towards me.
And he could have walked to that fence, couldn't he, if he wanted to?
He could have made a decisive turn and walked in the opposite direction, ending it all. He could have thrown that knife away, and it ended it all right then and there.
And how many times did you ask him to drop that knife?
Several.
And he never dropped that knife, did he?
No.
And he turned toward you with that knife drawn, right?
Yes.
And you saw McGilliga chasing him with a gun, right?
Yes.
And he had that knife out then, too, right?
That's correct.
And when he turned toward you, you said he raised that knife, right?
Yes.
And show us how he raised it again, please.
From his lower right side, going across his chest, upwards, towards his left shoulder.
And he's facing you at that point, right?
Yeah, his upper body's facing me. He's doing that.
And that's when you shot?
Yes.
Did you think you were going to get attacked at that point?
I'll allow that question to be asked. You can answer.
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
Recross examination, Ms. Gleason.
Is your testimony that he never turned his back towards you that night?
No, he did not turn his back towards me.
So it was impossible that you shot him in the back?
From what I saw in the video, he spun.
Well, when he's spinning, his back is obviously towards you, correct?
A short period of time, maybe like that.
And you could have ended it all the minute he hit the ground, correct?
Between the time of me realizing he hit the ground and reassessing it, after the assessment, you know, that's why I reassessed the situation, yes.
But you testified that even when you reassessed the situation, you continued to shoot him.
Because to me, it seemed like he was getting back up.
No,
and he was in the fight.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Van Dyke. You can step down. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take about a 10-minute break right now.
All right, for the jury.
What we're seeing here in Chicago today, live as it happened, the testimony of Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke in the 2014 shooting death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. Van Dyke at times emotional as he described what happened that night from his perspective, which seems to be somewhat contrary to the police dash cam video, but pointing out that from his perspective it looked different. And sir, really during this trial we saw a video recreation based on the dash cam video, which gives us a slightly different angle to where it looked like the teen was closing the distance between himself and Officer Van Dyke. The prosecution, though, trying to put some holes into the officer's testimony, his thinking, his timing, that he could have stopped, but he didn't. But Van Dyke kept saying that, no, from his perspective. And then there were other issues where she said, but you said that night. And he repeatedly said that night, I'm not sure what I told the supervising detective exactly the words. I was in shock. I was under stress after just the shooting. The words might have been different, but stuck to what he has been saying most recently, and that is that he felt there was a threat with Laquan McDonald, with the knife he had in his hands, with the look he had on his face as he looked at him as he approached and would not drop that knife. The jurors have a tough job ahead of them once this finally gets into their hands in terms of deliberation. The defense and the prosecution have both presented strong cases, each undermining the other's witnesses. It'll come down to what these jurors believe collectively and also how it applies to the law. It's not a matter of that the officer shot Laquan McDonald even 16 times, even though some see that as horrific in and of itself. The officer tried to explain on the witness stand that he continued to perceive a threat, even when the teen was on the ground, because he would not let go of the knife, looked to be getting up in his view. Will that be enough for the jury, or will the jury look at the police dash cam video and say, no, he's making that up? It was very emotional testimony on the behalf of the officer, but it will be up to those jurors collectively to come up with a decision and also to base it on the law, whether it adds up to first-degree murder and the parameters thereof. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more of our Inside the Courtroom coverage. Right now, the jury is on recess for roughly, the court on recess, roughly 10 minutes. If you've been with us here inside the courtroom this afternoon, Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke did take the stand at his murder trial in his own defense for the 2014 fatal shooting of black teen Laquan McDonald. And it was emotional at points. In fact, he became very emotional when describing what happened the night that he shot and killed McDonald. Let's listen.
And did he keep advancing toward
you? He never stopped.
How close did he get to you?
Probably about 10 to 15 feet away from me.
When he got 10 to 15 feet away from me, what did he do?
We never lost eye contact. Eyes were bugged out. His face was just expressionless. And turned his torso towards me.
And what did he do with his arm?
He waved the knife from his lower right side upwards across his body towards my left shoulder.
And when he did that, what did you do, officer?
I shot him.
What was Laquan McDonald doing?
Advancing on me.
And could you see him, his face?
Yeah, I could. I won't
forget it. What, if anything, did you notice about his face?
His face had no expression. His eyes were just bugging out of his head. He had just these huge white eyes just staring right through me.
And did you say anything to Laquan McDonald?
I was yelling at him, drop the knife. I yelled I don't know how many times, but that's all I yelled. I shot at that knife. I wanted him to get rid of that knife.
Okay, let's talk about the knife. You're not trained as a police officer to shoot at somebody's knife, are you?
No, you're not.
You're trained to shoot at center mass, correct?
Yes.
So why would you continue to shoot at his knife? That's not what you're trained to do.
My focus was just on that knife, and I just wanted him to get rid of that knife. That's all I could think.
Paul Lisnick, our legal analyst, back with us now. And that last portion of testimony about shooting at the knife was why he continued to shoot while Laquan McDonald was on the ground, or why he said he did. And he said that he felt, from his perspective, it looked like Laquan McDonald was maybe trying to get up, but also was still holding onto that knife and staring at him, and so he fired. The prosecution, of course, Paul, came up then and had their chance to, and actually that was the prosecution in the end, the woman asking that question. But he stayed steadfast with why he did what he did, and questioned about however he told the lead detective that night is what happened. Statements were a little different than from what they are now, and he said he just couldn't remember exactly what he told that detective that night. He said, because I was in shock. There was a lot of stress. The shooting had just happened. Is that believable to the jury, especially in light of psychologist testimony that says, you know, the brain in shock or in a high-stress situation doesn't pick up every little thing?
So I think that the fact that there may be some discrepancies in a statement he gave that evening with later testimony or situations, I think we can expect there to be some discrepancies because of those reasons. I mean, all this stuff is going on. But I don't think that's what the jury's really going to be looking at here. I think the jury's going to be looking at those videotapes they've seen dozens of times. Certainly the one that was the actual footage, but also that one that was created by the defense team with scientific standards applied, but nevertheless showing Van Dyke's perspective on it. I think in the end, the jury is going to judge his reasonableness and his actions based on believe what your own eyes see, right? But based on that video, when he says he was 10 feet away from me, 10 to 15 away from me, is that what indeed it shows on the video that was created by the defense team?
It got it down to about 13 feet. But what you don't see in either video, the dash cam video or the recreation video, is any type of a movement that would imply sort of a, this kind of a thing. But you do, as he says, points his, he keeps his torso framed towards him, doesn't back away. And the prosecution tried to undermine that in sort of an interesting way that seemed a bit disingenuous to me anyway watching it, just simply because she says, what, you never shot in the back? He never had his back towards you? Well, when you shot him in the back at one point. And he says, well, because he spun. But never when he was approaching, he says, was McDonald's back toward him. He said that distance was being closed. And then when the bullet hit, the teen spun. And so, yes, that's where, as he was still firing, a bullet hit him in the back. That's McDonald's, that's Officer Van Dyke's
right.
Take on this.
And indeed, look, that's all happening very quickly. So, you know, that's frame by frame, taking a look at things. When did he start spinning? They can see that. I was actually moved very much by the last clip that we showed there, where essentially the prosecutor says, let's remember that part of Van Dyke's defense here is I was trained. I followed my training. If you have a problem with what I did, talk to the CPD that trained me to do this. And so what you had was a prosecutor saying you weren't trained to shoot somebody with a knife. And he paused.
Well, she was basically saying you weren't trained to shoot at the hand. You were trained to shoot center mass. And he's saying he just wanted to get the knife out of his hand, which almost sounds like he was trying to not shoot for center mass because he just wanted the knife away.
And I think that, again, we'll see what the jury does with that information. But once again, this is not a toy gun. This is not, you know, so to sort of say, as he said, I just couldn't get my eyes off the knife. I wanted it out of his hand. You know, this is not a carnival game where we're going to just try and take some shots at your hand, because as you said, that's not the training. So, and the question, as she said, was you're not trained to shoot at that knife. I think it's going to resonate with jurors in terms of what was he trained to do? What should he have done? Was it reasonable? It's all a big picture. And that, for better or for worse, that's the piece they needed. That's the piece they wanted. He has spoken now. He has spoken his truth as to what it is he believes happened. And we'll see what the jury does with it.
Very much so. Also interesting, in terms of that knife and on the ground, there was a piece of testimony last week where the defense called, I believe it was a police sergeant who handles roll call and whatnot, and he talked about a 2012 memo, an officer alert memo that the police department had received about revolver knives, just to So officers were in the know. It was brought up during roll call. He said 4 days in a row. They posted on the bulletin board. Each officer would have gotten a copy. So it's there in your mind somewhere probably that he said that he'd never had instance of one being recovered on the streets of Chicago. But these knives that could shoot bullets. So is in closing arguments, will the defense potentially tie that one in? Who knows as to why he kept shooting?
It depends what the evidence is. You can't just say things that aren't backed up or supplied in evidence. You know, if Van Dyke had testified that, you know,
he thought it was a roll. That wasn't brought up. Yeah.
Exactly. So without Van Dyke being able to back it up.
Let's listen in.
Instruct the jury on the law, and a witness should certainly not interpret the law either.
Judge, I will state that it's not the jury instruction.
Yes. All right, whoa. Let's go on the first slide, which got case law. Huh?
Yes, it's Gray versus Connor, which is what has
is been. That case law?
It's yes.
Okay, it's not coming in.
That's the basis for his opinion.
He's given a legal opinion?
No.
Well, then why would a case, was it a United States Supreme Court case?
Yes.
And he's interpreting the law from the Supreme Court?
No. He's not.
All right. The other thing is, so what if he used it? We have discussed this before. Hearsay and non-admissible evidence can be used by an expert in forming their opinion. But it can't be brought on direct, but it can be brought on cross-examination if they dare to. All right. So
that's fine.
Thank you. All right, you ready?
Yes.
All right, bring the jury out, please.
All right, for the jury.
So as we wait for the jury to come back in, and we'll hear if the defense has another witness, if they're going to rest. Usually, Paul, you said when you put the defendant on himself, that usually is the wrap. But
that should be the wrap. But again, you know, this not everything goes according to plan. So there may have been something. We just heard a motion being discussed. There may have been something that got said by Van Dyke that the defense now feels they need to address. Or they may want to end this case on a different note and with a different witness. We're going to soon see.
Exactly. There was question over a certain slide that they were trying to use earlier, so there was that. We had heard throughout the last couple of days that they were going to bring in some sort of use of force person beyond the psychologist today, but not clear if that's going to happen. Maybe that person will wrap it up, but clearly, once they get around to closing arguments, that's where we're going to hear each side sort of paint their picture in total, correct?
Absolutely, and I mean, for viewers, if they've been following this trial, that's the one thing you sure don't want to miss at this point, because the opening statement of the lawyers basically saying, here's what we think the evidence will show, here's what we hope to show you, but now the evidence will be in. And so now we'll have to hear what it is, how the lawyers pull it all together.
They have called another witness. Let's listen.
Swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give before this honorable court and jury shall be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so together.
I do.
Thank you.
Have a seat. The chair is adjustable. The microphone is live, so pull your seat up to the microphone, adjust the microphone, speak into the microphone, and it would be greatly appreciated. Thank you. Proceed, Mr. Herb.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm good.
Would you please introduce yourself and spell your last name?
My name is Barry Vance Broad. Last name spelled B-R-O, D as in David, D as in David.
And Mr. Broad, can you tell us about your current employment?
I provide expert witness services in police practices and both police and civilian self-defense cases.
What is the name of your company?
BVB and Associates.
When did BVB and Associates come into existence?
1995.
Okay, and what are your duties essentially within the organization of BVB and Associates?
I'm approached by district attorney offices, attorneys, dealing with police officer use of force or allegations of police misconduct or police excessive force.
And sir, do you have any training in law enforcement?
I do.
Can you please tell ladies and gentlemen of the jury about your background and training?
I graduated college in 1975 with a bachelor's degree from George Mason University. I became a deputy sheriff in Arlington County, Virginia in 1975 until 1976. 1976, I was hired as a federal law enforcement officer with the United States Park Police, both in Washington, D.C. and in San Francisco, California. I lateraled to the Santa Rosa Police Department in 1982, where I retired in 2004 after 29 years.
And do you belong to any memberships?
I belong to PORAC, which is the Peace Officers Research Association of California. It's the labor organization that represents just about all the police and sheriff's offices. I belong to the International Police Officers Association, and I belong to a training company called ILETA, which is International Law Enforcement Educators Training Association.
Mr. Broad, have you conducted any training with regard to police officers and use of force?
I have. In 1978, I was certified by the FBI as a defensive tactics use of force instructor. I started teaching at the Santa Rosa Police Academy in 1979 as an adjunct faculty member. And I taught use of force subjects from 1979 till I retired in 2013.
Mr. Broad, have you consulted with any clients on use of force cases?
I have, on approximately 100 incidences.
And did any of those cases involve fatal police shootings?
Yes.
Have you ever testified in court, or strike that, have you ever testified regarding your representation of a client and police use of force?
So since 2013, I've given testimony on 29 different occasions. 13 of those were trial testimony and 16 were deposition testimony. My experience, I've dealt with 22 officer-involved shooting investigations that I've consulted on.
And Mr. Broad, the clients that you have, are they all from the plaintiff's side or the pro-police side or the anti-police side? How would you characterize your clients over the years?
Initially, probably 80% of my clients were plaintiff's attorneys alleging some type of police officer misconduct. I currently have 14 active cases, of which 7 are criminal, where I'm working on behalf of the defense. The remaining 7 are civil, 3 of which I'm working for plaintiffs alleging police misconduct, and the remaining 3 I'm working on defense of police officers.
Mr. Broad, do you have any part of your work assignments, do they deal with the San Francisco Review Agency?
I'm a consultant for, it's a newly formed branch of the San Francisco District Attorney called the Independent Investigations Bureau. Due to changes in officer-involved shooting protocol in San Francisco, the District Attorney's Office is now the lead agency, and I provide my expertise to those investigators who are now primarily responsible for investigating San Francisco police officer-involved shootings.
Mr. Broad, have you been accepted as an expert in the area of use of force in any of your previous cases?
On probably 30 to 40 prior occasions.
Have you ever not been accepted as an expert when you have been purported to be an expert by your client?
No.
Your Honor, at this time I would like to declare...
You don't do that.
I know.
You can request.
I forgot the word. At this point, I would ask that the court recognize Mr. Broad as an expert in the area of police use of force.
Any questions, Dave?
No, I didn't. I don't have any questions.
Thank you. All right. I find that Mr. Vod is qualified to testify as an expert in the use of force. Proceed.
Mr. Broad, you were contacted by me, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And we asked you to look at some documents and render an opinion in this case, correct?
Documents and materials.
Okay. Tell ladies and gentlemen of the jury what, in fact, you reviewed in assessing the situation to determine what your opinion was.
So I looked at the video. I looked at the Chicago Police Department officer-involved shooting investigation. I've read numerous interview transcripts from involved officers. I've read the autopsy report. I've read Dr. Miller's analysis of Officer Van Dyke. I reviewed Dr. O'Donnell's toxicology report. I reviewed Dr. T's, if I'm correcting her, reviewed her report. I've had a lot of contact with Mr. Jason Fries as he developed his recreation animation. And I think that about covers it.
Okay. And I don't know, did you say that you spoke to Mr. Van Dyke at all?
I'm sorry, I spoke to Mr. Van Dyke on two occasions.
Okay. And the terms of our agreement, when we asked you to review this, what was the understanding about what opinion you were going to give?
Look at the materials that you provided and give an opinion on whether I felt Officer Van Dyke was justified in the levels of force that he used.
Okay. And have you ever been asked to render an opinion that eventually turned out was not favorable to the client?
So I was never asked to render an opinion unfavorable. I have been hired to look at cases and determine that there was nothing I could do to help them.
Okay. And in this case, were you able to render an opinion about Jason Van Dyke's use of force based upon your experience and everything that you reviewed?
I was.
And can you tell us what that opinion is?
I feel that Officer Van Dyke's shooting of Laquan McDonald was justified.
And with respect to, there's different volleys of shots in this case, you're aware of that fact, correct?
Yes.
And at any point, did you have any reservations about one or more of the volleys?
I did.
And can you please tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury about that?
So when I first looked at the video and the materials I was provided, I was confident that the first volley of rounds fired by Officer Van Dyke, in my opinion, were justified. And I had questions about the second volley.
If I can ask you to stop there, why is it that your opinion was that the Jason Van Dyke's first volley of shots was justified?
Based upon what I saw of the video and the distance that seemed to be represented in the video, and the close proximity of Mr. McDonald to Officer Van Dyke, and what had led up to this confrontation between Officer Van Dyke and Mr. McDonald, and the fact that Mr. McDonald was armed with an edged weapon.
And I'm sorry, if you can go and go ahead and speak to your opinion with respect to the second volley of shots.
So I wasn't sure. So I was given additional information. I read Dr. Miller's report. I had a telephone interview with Officer Van Dyke. And based upon those two additional sources of information, I rendered an opinion that the second volley, that Officer Van Dyke was still under imminent threat by his observations, and I felt that that was a reasonable conclusion.
And when you say by his observations, did you determine that his observations were reasonable for a police officer in that same situation?
In dealing with a lot of these prior cases that are captured either on an officer's body camera, which isn't a situation here, or with the car cam, they very rarely show what the officer is actually seeing or what the actual lighting conditions are that the officer's eye is seeing. You know, the cameras will pick up different lighting variations, and the shutter on a body cam will show light situations that are more favorable. So what answered my question was having Officer Van Dyke tell me what he was looking at when he decided to fire that second volley.
Mr. Broad, you know that Jason Van Dyke was approximately 12, 14 feet away from Mr. McDonald at the point in which he decided that he needed to use deadly force, correct?
Normally, you'd be perfectly correct, but this has been in evidence on about every other witness, so overruled at this time. Go ahead.
So we're saying 12 to 14 feet?
Yes, approximately.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. And what is it about 12 to 14 feet that you believed Laquan McDonald was an imminent threat to Jason Van Dyke?
So you have Officer Van Dyke who will be reacting to Mr. McDonald's movements. So there's a lag time of reaction, plus the time it would take to close distance between 12 to 14 feet to where Officer Van Dyke was standing would take second and a half to 1.7 seconds. And in that time, Officer Van Dyke would have had to make the decision to use lethal force and administer enough lethal force to stop the threat to prevent him or Officer Walsh from being stabbed.
And, Your Honor, at this point, I would ask that the witness be allowed to step down from the witness area, and we can conduct a demonstration showing the distance of 13 feet.
Certainly, you can step down.
And I will note that we have a toy knife here, which is plastic, and I would ask that Mr. Broad be allowed to hold on to that knife for purposes of this demonstration.
Certainly. Do you want to watch this, Mr. Cullen?
Thank you, yes.
Okay.
I can ask you to hold that, and then we're going to count off to 13 feet. Okay, so right here is 13 feet. Can you hold that? I'm sorry. It's set up as fine. Right here is 13 feet. Okay? Mr. Broad, if I am Jason Van Dyke, standing 13 feet away from you, why is it that your testimony is that this is a distance that could be any threat to Mr. Van Dyke?
And I'll show you how much time you would have to react to me.
Not to denigrate you in any way, but you're not a young man.
No.
Okay. How old are you?
I'm 64 years old.
Okay.
With a knee replacement.
If I can have 1 minute, please, Judge.
Examination, Mr. Cullen. Please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, Mr. Fry, there's a number of things that were artificial about the little demonstration you just did. Is that correct?
Artificial? Sure.
Yes, artificial. Because that's not what happened on October 20th of 2014, was it?
The distance was accurate, but the movements weren't.
The movements weren't. In fact, because on October 20th of 2014, Jason Van Dyke wasn't sitting here, standing with his arms behind, right?
That's correct.
He was pointing a handgun at Laquan McDonald, is that correct?
Yes, he was.
Now, you approached with a knife, with a pretend knife, with a kind of a large blade, is that correct?
Yes.
Now, Laquan McDonald, the knife wasn't that long, was it?
3 inches.
Now, in your report, you wrote 4 inches. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
That would be an exaggeration. Is that correct?
I would call it more of an inaccuracy.
A Okay, and an accuracy that makes the situation more dangerous or something. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
An inaccuracy that would make Laquan McDonald more dangerous sounding. Is that correct?
As far as the difference between a 3-inch bladed knife and a 4, no, I don't think so.
Now, but you chose 4.
I chose 4.
For a 3-inch blade?
Yes.
Now, Mr. Brad, how much have you charged the defense for your services?
I've been paid $12,400.
Well, how much more are you going to be paid?
I'm not sure yet.
Well, what is it that needs to be yet determined?
My length of time on the stand, travel time back to California, etc.
And how much are you charging for the length of time on the witness stand?
$350 an hour.
So you've rendered an opinion here, and you said that you based that on various items that the defense provided you. Is that correct?
Yes.
You looked at Dr. Miller's report. Is that correct?
I did.
You didn't see his testimony, though, did you?
No.
You looked at Dr. O'Donnell's report. Is that correct?
I did.
You consulted with Mr. Fries. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you helped him create this video that the defense has presented, which shows a highly accurate rendition of what the defendant saw. Is that correct?
Actually, I conversed with Mr. Fries, but I didn't really provide any information to him.
Well, you conversed with him a number of times. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then, of course, you talked to the defendant, and after you talked to him, you changed your opinion as to whether or not the shots on the ground were justified. Is that your testimony?
No.
Now, you said that why do you believe that the defendant was justified in shooting Laquan McDonald the first time?
Based upon what Officer Van Dyke knew regarding Mr. McDonald.
What did he know about Mr. McDonald?
That Mr. McDonald had attacked a Chicago police car by popping a tire.
And he also knew that he had done that in order to evade those police officers. Is that correct?
Are you asking if I knew that or Officer Van Dyke knew that?
Well, would Officer Van Dyke have known that?
I'm not sure.
Okay. And yet you believe that it was justified because you assume that that's what he knew?
I made that opinion based upon the fact that Mr. McDonald was armed and standing within 12 to 14 feet of Officer Van Dyke.
Now, if you had your badge on now, could you kill me because I'm standing within 12 to 15 feet of you and I'm armed?
And I tell you to drop the knife?
And I don't drop the knife?
I would consider you a threat.
You would kill me?
Possibly.
Okay. And if I defied you and was walking toward a fence, you'd still kill me?
Not sure.
Okay.
You know, I don't have any further questions for that.
Mr. Herbert.
Mr. Brian, you were asked, by the state's attorney about the demonstration that me and you conducted. And I believe you said, well, that wasn't really what happened that night, correct?
That's correct.
Well, in fact, this was the knife that night, and it wasn't this toy knife with blue tape on it, right?
That's correct.
It was this knife, correct?
Yes.
And in fact, me and you have met, and we talked, and we know each other.
Your objection to bleeding it.
Again, this is redirect. You can lead on redirect. Otherwise, you have to go through the direct testimony all over again, counsel. All right, go ahead. Overrule.
I don't know if I can answer that question. Or not. I'll ask it again. me and you know each other, and certainly...
That's outside the scope of cross-examination. Get on with it.
Okay. You're not whacked out on PCP right now, are you?
No.
Okay. And we're in a courtroom right here with sheriff's deputies, and we're surrounded by, we have a judge right here, so it's not real life, right?
I feel very safe.
Okay. And but on the night in which Jason Van Dyke met Laquan McDonald, there wasn't any protection, such as being in a courtroom with deputies and people all around, correct?
That's correct.
It was a dangerous, real-life situation, correct?
Yes.
Mr. Cullen.
Now, you've looked at the videos, you've looked at the reports, and did you hear a testimony that there was no protection that Jason Van Dyke had? Is that correct?
I said there was no physical barriers between himself and Mr. McDonald.
Well, you just told Mr. Herbert there was no physical barriers, or did you just say there was no protection?
I'm not sure.
Because there was significant protection that the officers had that night, wasn't there?
I'm going to object to the officers. I'm talking about my client. That's fine.
Well, do you understand the question?
I do. I just don't understand what you mean by protection.
Well, Jason Van Dyke had a pistol. Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
Jason Van Dyke had a firearm. Did he not?
Yes.
He had a partner standing next to him with a firearm, didn't he?
Yes.
He had a squad SUV, is that correct?
Yes.
Capable of knocking people over, is that correct?
It could.
He had a bevy of other Chicago police officers immediately around him, did he not?
And what you mean by immediately?
Well, within his sight, on Pulaski Street in Chicago.
So that's immediate, so I'm not sure if that was in Officer Van Dyke's sight. There were other officers present.
Okay. Was there anything that would have prevented Officer Van Dyke, before he approached Laquan McDonald, from seeing the squad car that was following him?
Anything that could have stopped him from seeing it? No.
Any reason for you to believe that he didn't know that there was a squad car immediately behind him?
I don't know if he knew that or not.
Okay. Because he may not have been paying attention?
Absolutely.
Okay. And was there anything preventing him from knowing that Officer Velez and her partner were in a squad car right next to Laquan McDonald before the defendant got out and shot Laquan McDonald? Anything preventing him from seeing that?
If he didn't look that way, yes. If not, I'm not sure.
Okay. And what about the other squad cars that are shown in the video with their lights flashing? Would there have been anything else, or anything that would prevent the defendant from knowing that he had that protection available to him?
Again, the fact that there's other officers there, I'm not sure if Officer Van Dyke would consider that protection.
And the fact that the radio dispatch indicated that there was a taser on the way, which arrived about 20 seconds after the shooting.
That's not the evidence. There was no evidence that there was a taser on the way.
Sustained.
That a taser had been called for and an officer responded, we're on the way.
Objection. It's not the evidence.
The jury's heard the evidence. The other thing is, he rephrased. Go ahead, Mr. Cullen.
I have no further questions, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hold on.
Yeah, thank you. Could I have the attorneys over here for a second, please?
So, defense use of force expert who's just testified, who spent time in law enforcement for many, many years, has taught use of force to police recruits and as a college level. He, again, is the defense expert, saying that in reviewing the situation, the videos, and talking to Officer Van Dyke, that his initial thinking was that the first volley of shots, rounds fired, was justified because Officer Van Dyke reasonably perceived a threat in Laquan McDonald. He said he did question the second round after McDonald fell to the ground, but then in further investigation, some of the other evidence in the case, and again talking to Van Dyke, he felt that Van Dyke, from his observation, still felt under threat, and that's why he did that second round of shots. But clearly the prosecution tried to put some holes in his testimony, especially, and the defense seemed to open this up when it showed that the knife that the prosecution raised was basically almost like a toy knife, and tried to show this bigger knife, and saying that was in a courtroom situation, but Officer Van Dyke didn't have that kind of protection that night, and the witness said, no, he really didn't, because it's a real-life situation. But right there, he had all these cops around him, and the prosecution jumped on that. Officer Van Dyke didn't have protection around him that he could rely on. So,
and, of course, jurors know, as we also heard, this witness's, expert witness's fees of $350 an hour, which, by the way, I got to tell you, the world of witness expert witnesses, it's no big deal, you know, and jurors come to understand that these people are paid for their time and attention, but nevertheless, it still sometimes can be astounding when you hear these kinds of numbers and how much is he being paid and how much is going on and who's paying him and why was he brought in. So the jurors are very well aware that any expert brought in by any side of any case is certainly there because they're probably going to support the theories being put forth by their client. In this case, the defense wants him on. So.
Well, and the use of force expert that the prosecution had on early on did not feel it was justifiable use of force. This guy said that he felt it was, again, going with the prosecution's, the defense side of things. But interestingly, Dan Herbert, the defense attorney, made a point with this witness and also the psychologist today, two expert, big expert witnesses today, pointing out that though there have been times, though, when after you reviewed the case, you didn't testify as to what. And they sort of said, well, yeah, there have been times when they just didn't then accept the case or they didn't go forward with it.
Well, that's true. And because, by the way, look, when you have an expert witness on the stand, the other side is going to look at they get their resume, they know what they've done, they can look at every case they've testified in or haven't testified in. So I think it's important for the credibility of an expert witness to be able to say, no, I'm not a paid shill who will take the stand every single case I'm hired to do. Sometimes my answer is no, I can't support your theory and I have to go. And there's credibility that comes with that. I think the experts in this case almost cancel each other out. The jury may very well look at the plaintiff, the prosecution, defense witness, and say, well, they just disagree with each other. You have a tape here. You have a tape. You have Jason Van Dyke's testimony, and wouldn't surprise me if we are allowed to talk to the witnesses afterwards, or if they speak, if we were to find out that in the end that was the most persuasive thing that leads them to their verdict.
Well, and in watching Jason Van Dyke, it was compelling to watch him. He teared up at points, you know, just especially when he had to recount firing the weapon, what was going through his mind. But he also seemed, when the prosecution came at him with cross-examination, like he was almost getting a little bit, it seemed belligerent in some ways, and I don't know if that's really a fair word. But saying, well, I don't know where the video stops because it's not on my screen, when the prosecutor asked him, or when referring to Walsh, and he said, well, there was no Dr. Walsh. And she said, Detective Walsh. And he said, it's Officer Walsh. So there were some points of showing frustration, or is it just that, you know, so I don't know how the jurors will take that. But it's that, and then it's again both sides, the dash cam video here, the recreation video here that the defense did, showing it from the officer's perspective, where indeed the teen looks to be closing the gap, coming at him as he's holding the knife while the officer's telling him to drop it. But what we don't see on either video, and it hasn't been addressed unless it will be in closing arguments by the defense, is Officer Van Dyke has testified to this. His partner early on testified to this, that when Laquan McDonald was approaching with that knife, he went sort of like this and just looked at them. In that video or the recreation, you don't see that sort of a movement. You see a knife kind of hear.
Yeah, you also had Officer Van Dyke saying in that period of time, we never lost eye contact, right? So it wouldn't surprise, by the way, the jurors are given the evidence. They can look through this evidence if they want to see it, so they can explore it. So I would be not surprised to learn that they watched both of these videotapes over and over again. I just think in this particular case, where the video has almost defined this case from the get-go, that the jurors are going to put a lot of weight on that. Jurors understand that, you know, eyewitnesses are eyewitnesses, but they can be wrong in what they remember or misremember.
Because we know that about ourselves.
Exactly. And sometimes, actually, if you don't see something, there's a lot of research to show that if I were to tell you, if you were in a room and I tell you, oh, there was a pink elephant sitting in the corner and you didn't see it, you actually, research will show, you'll start actually saying, well, I think it was this pink elephant. I don't mean a big pink elephant, but I mean something. If I tell you that there's something in the room that really isn't there, you'll actually claim that you saw it because you wouldn't want to be wrong. You wouldn't want to say that it wasn't. And by the way, yeah, and in this research, they'll even show you a picture. Look, here's a picture of it in the room. It's all part of research, right? People want to remember. They want to be right. They want to be accurate. And so sometimes we fill in the gaps and fill in the pieces in order to explain something that is otherwise unexplainable.
Well, we should just mention court is recessed for the day at this point, but the attorneys were still going over some matters with the judge, evidentiary matters. There's a good chance that the defense will then rest tomorrow, and then we'll hear about when closing arguments would be scheduled again, but they're working things out in the courtroom.
We will, by the way, one more perfunctory thing will happen, which is the defense will make another motion for directed verdict, basically saying to the judge, you know what? They didn't prove their case. Now that let us go home. Those have to be made for the record. The judge will not grant it.
Well, and in terms of the evidence, you said the jurors will go over the evidence and over the evidence. But now, I don't know, it could change up, but maybe it's always different. One legal person we had on earlier said that for sure that police dash cam video will be in the jury room with the jurors because it's actual evidence, camera of the scene, whatever, police dash cam video, and they can replay that a million times. But this 3D recreation, he described it as being of demonstrative evidence that potentially would not be allowed in because whatever rules of the court. Now, I'm not clear which one or the other, but that would be interesting if they could only replay one but not the other in comparison.
Well, and again, part of that depends on what purposes the judge admits something into evidence. Something being admitted for demonstration is different than something being admitted for evidence to be considered for the verdict. So now, what you will probably find, the jurors don't understand those distinctions either. So they're liable to send a note to the judge saying, we want to see this or we want to review that, and the judge will have to explain to them why they're not being given access to something, or without those kind of details, simply saying, you know, I'm denying your request, you simply must proceed with what's been made available to you.
If that were an actual question in this case that came out of the jury, and then they felt, because all they could keep watching was the dash cam video, which looks like Laquan McDonald could be sort of walking away or at least meandering towards a fence, whereas in the recreation video, which was based on science and the prosecution didn't undermine the science here, shows the teen to be closing the gap from the officer's perspective. If they send out that question and the judge says this particular video and they said, no, you saw it in the courtroom, but that's it. You can only have the police dash cam, and then they convict the officer. Is that grounds for the appeal right there that they couldn't evenly weigh, or are the rules of evidence so strong that that's not an excuse for having
The rules of evidence are designed to be applied, right?
Interpretation then?
Exactly. So, I mean, the rules say you can admit this evidence, you can't admit that. The rules say you can do this, you can't do that. So, essentially, and as I've said earlier, the judge is very conscious of every decision, every ruling, every question that he goes, that's overruled or that's sustained. Every time the judge rules, that is a record being made for a potential appeal in the event of a conviction. So, and when you say, could the defense argue this if they're convicted, the defense will argue everything there is to argue in order to get an appellate court to say, you deserve a new trial.
To see if something sticks.
To see what sticks. Lawyers differ about the strategy of doing that. Some would say, you know what, don't just throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. Pick your best arguments and try and make an intelligent argument to the court. But appellate courts are very aware, especially criminal cases, that, you know, the defendant is trying to find something for a court to say, that wasn't fair. That needs to be looked at again.
Okay, well, we're understanding now, based on our courtroom observers, now that the jury's out of there, that they went over whatever with the attorneys, and the defense will now rest formally tomorrow, which we'll bring to you live with the jury back in. Then the prosecution will do whatever, and how does that
motion
proceed?
Well, we'll have that motion, and then it'll be time for closing arguments. So at this point, if they are meeting with the judge, they're probably scheduling how they want to handle the closing arguments. Remember, the prosecution's going to go first because they had the burden, so they're going to have to show the jury that we prove what we said we would. Then the defense is going to get up and say, well, let me show you how they didn't prove what they said. But the prosecution gets the final word. The party with the final burden of proof, the ultimate burden of proof, gets the final word to the jury. So the last thing the jurors will hear before they go off to deliberate and, of course, get jury instructions will be the arguments of the prosecution.
So, okay, so, Paul, tomorrow morning, if this works as we're thinking it will, that we start again tomorrow morning between 9 and 10, as has been the history, that we're set for 9 o'clock, but it doesn't always happen right at 9, that's when the defense will formally rest in front of the jurors. Mm-hmm. Do we expect that the closing arguments would begin right away, or would they schedule them for the following day?
Well, that depends. That's part of what the court is discussing now with the lawyers. So, you know, look, we didn't know it was coming next. We're waiting to see what happens, but certainly the lawyers know whether we're going to wrap up and when we're going to wrap up. So, and this judge is sort of moving things along. This is not the kind of judge who's going to say, why don't you, let's start Monday and go ahead and take some time and relax. I think what we can expect here is the judge either to ask whether either side will be ready to go, or the judge could say, I want all these arguments done in one day, and so we'll make some motions, and then we will begin all the arguments on that point. It'll be Thursday, and hand this case to the jury. We do find jurors don't like to usually, you know, if you're coming to a Friday, it's always interesting how these cases end, and there's a Friday around the corner. Mm. But generally speaking, it isn't usual, I think, that if you get to a Friday afternoon, the jurors are going to simply come back Monday when they're in the middle of deliberation. They tend to want to kind of wrap things up. So if the closing arguments are ordered to happen tomorrow by the judge, and if those get done tomorrow, and that is certainly possible, and the case goes to the jury, say, Thursday morning after instructions, because it does take time for the judge to instruct the jury. You know, if I were a betting man, I'd say I would expect a verdict by the end of Business Friday.
Okay, well, after
jurors always want their free lunch, so they will definitely not do it before lunch, that I can tell you.
Okay, you heard it here. He's putting his wager out there. Gotta get the lunch. Yeah. All of us do. All right, well, that wraps up our coverage. Paul, thanks for hanging out this afternoon. And this morning, of course, it was Igal Pasetsky. Thanks to him and to you for joining us. And we will be back here tomorrow morning when the defense rests and potentially closing arguments begin. So hope you can join us. We're going to hit a break. And then after that, the Ro Khan Show, as they do their WGN Radio wrap-up of the trial for today.